Hello, thanks for downloading this podcast of The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. We're on the radio, too. Radio, you know, that thing with the crank in your emergency kit. Radio. Well, it sounds a bit like this.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. Game of Thrones premiered last night. Did you see it? Here in America, we've got our own kind of Game of Thrones going. Well, we don't have a throne. Game of the Oval Office, right? Candidates are now vying left and right. Senator Marco Rubio has officially entered the 2016 political fray as a candidate for the Republican Party. We're going to talk more about Rubio in just a bit. But first, we go to a candidate with a much longer political history behind her, and it's a day we all knew was coming. This is the first day of Hillary Clinton's 2016 run for the White House. So far, she's the only major Democratic candidate to get in.
I'm running for president. Everyday Americans need a champion, and I want to be that champion. So you can do more than just get by. You can get ahead and stay ahead. Because when families are strong, America is strong.
Hillary Clinton's many titles tell part of the story of her career. Attorney for the Watergate hearings, First Lady of Arkansas, First Lady of the United States, Senator from New York, and Secretary of State. But when she first arrived on the Arkansas political scene way back in 1974, she annoyed a lot of people, men and women alike, on the heels of the women's movement by keeping her maiden name at first. A lot of people in Arkansas questioned the Clinton's marriage, and Hillary took her husband's name only in 1980. As the state's first lady, she focused mostly on children's rights and education.
The road to being somebody in this society starts with education. And we intend to be sure that everybody in this room and every child in this state is somebody, because we're going to give them every chance we can to develop their minds so that they can play a role in this state and this country to make it the kind of place it needs to be.
Hillary supported her husband's career through two terms in the White House, and then he supported her in turn when she ran for Senate against Rick Lazio in 2000. Well, here are the two candidates from back then in a debate over a campaign finance agreement.
I admire that. That was a wonderful performance. And
well, why don't you sign it?
And you did it very well.
I'm not asking you to admire it. I'm asking you to sign it.
Well, I would be happy to. When you give me the letters.
Right here.
Would you give
right
me?
Right here. Sign it right now.
Well, we'll shake on this.
No, I want your signature, because I think that everybody wants to see you signing something that you said you were for.
Well, today we want to focus on some of those possibly forgotten years in Hillary's career in Arkansas and a senator from New York and in the White House. Beth Harpaz is author of The Girls in the Van Covering Hillary. She's now travel editor for the Associated Press. And Max Brantley is a senior editor at the Arkansas Times, who's known the Clintons both as a reporter and a family friend for a long time. And he can trace Hillary's identity today all the way back to how she first established herself in Little Rock in the 70s.
Oh, I think she came to Arkansas as something of an outsider, a bit of a Chicago accent, educated at an elite school, kept her own name, and that rubbed a very traditional state a little bit wrong, but I think she soon turned it around. Among many people, she was probably more popular than Bill was. He was a polarizing figure. He always won, well, with one notable exception, but he made enemies. She had a highly positive image from her work on education reform.
Max Brantley, there are so many points along the career that we can touch on, and since you're a Clinton family friend and you've spent a lot of time with them over the years, I'm interested in which parts of Hillary's experience you think are the very most formative for the person who wants to be elected president today. You have those battles of 1974. You had the distrust of Arkansas people who thought she was a carpetbagger even at the time. A similar attitude when she ran for the Senate in 2000 in New York, when people accused her of being entitled and she had to do a lot of work to get elected, talking to regular people. And now you see the echoes of that today in her announcement. Give us a window into what you see as sort of the formation of the Hillary Clinton that we're being asked to support today.
I think the most remarkable thing about both Clintons to a degree, and certainly her after the Whitewater experience, is the willingness to go back on the stage and endure what you have to endure in a presidential campaign when you consider how she's been under nearly constant attack for 25 years. Unless you were here on the ground during the Whitewater investigation, I don't think you can understand how intense it was and what an all-out assault it was on just about everybody who ever knew the Clintons in the effort by Kenneth Starr to find something to pin on. A lot of people wouldn't want to come back after all that.
Well, Beth Harpaz, those things really are central points of Hillary's career. Controversy, enemies, secrecy and a perseverance to keep facing your enemies. You can mention Whitewater, as Max Brantley did. You can mention Hillary's early time as First Lady in Arkansas. You can flash forward all the way to emails in the aftermath of her term as Secretary of State. You can look at accusations of secrecy during Hillary care when she was trying to reform the healthcare system as First Lady in the White House. Accusations of secrecy may be well-founded, and a willingness to face those accusations and keep fighting.
I think the one maybe a bigger theme that you're missing, and one of the reasons I wrote the book, The Girls in the Van, is that I felt like we were so involved in the horse race and Monica Lewinsky and all of those internecine battles and, you know, complaints that voters rightly have about the Clintons and their secrecy, is this enormous theme of the sense of destiny and the quest for a woman to make it to the highest office in the United States. I don't think that we can underplay that. It was a huge theme in the Senate campaign. She broke the mold as First Lady. She was the only First Lady to ever run and win elective office in New York State. So I don't think you can discount that, because I think that sense of quest began at that time. She was a First Lady unlike any other First Lady we've ever had, except maybe Eleanor Roosevelt. I mean, look, Laura Bush, literacy, nice, safe issue for First Ladies. Michelle Obama, and I mean no disrespect, but she is known as a fashion icon. She's known for her sense of fun, the mom dances, and for taking on, you know, what are relatively safe issues, fitness, nutrition. Okay, now let's look at Hillary as First Lady. She goes to China and she lectures the government on infanticide, you know, the health care debacle. Nobody elected Hillary to fix that problem, but the fact is that she tackled something that was a very complicated and important issue and became an expert on it, and something that's still really important. So, you know, her failure to win the nomination last time around, in some sense, I think it almost increased that sense of, we're just waiting for this to happen. And when I say we, I mean a lot of female voters in particular, you know, who felt like it's time. You know, women got the vote in 1920 and we still haven't gotten to the White House. And don't forget, when she ran in 2007, 2008, there were all kinds of questions that we didn't know the answer to. You know, could a woman raise the kind of money that you need to launch a presidential campaign? We didn't know that till Hillary did it. And now we know the answer is yes. So I feel like the women's issue or the women's theme of this campaign is enormously important. Whether we talk about it all the time or not, it's there. And it started long ago. That's who she is, like it or not.
Max Brantley, do you see that same drive? You know, a lot of people are hardcore supporters of Hillary Clinton, and that's great. Those that aren't tend to have a very negative view of the way they feel she operates. And you've seen them operate in Arkansas. What's your take on that?
Oh, I think some of it's a double standard. I think things are applied to her that are not applied to men. It's famous and it's cliched, but a strong woman is a bitch and a strong man is a strong man. Hillary's record as a feminist goes back to her day as well as the college, and I don't think you can underestimate the formative value that those years spent at that famous college lent to her. She was made famous from her famous valedictory speech in which she took on a sitting U.S. senator. It's, you know, we've made a lot of progress in the U.S., but not nearly enough. When she came to Little Rock, she was the first woman to be hired as an associate, not a partner, of a mainline law firm in Little Rock. That's how far behind we were. And so I think she's been surmounting these obstacles for now going on 45 years.
But let's bring it to today, Max Brantley, and you might be a good person to answer this question. Because even people who followed Hillary Clinton's career for many, many years understand she has enemies, understand she's under scrutiny, understand maybe there's a double standard. But that still doesn't explain to them perhaps what was going through her mind as Secretary of State when she decided to have private emails and then to be the arbiter of those emails, deciding which of those emails the public would see when it's time to disclose her activities as Secretary of State. You know the Clinton personality and maybe the way she thinks.
I think that the theme of a resistance to full disclosure of internal communications has been persistent throughout her career. I was at a dinner party this weekend where we talked about just this question, is how could you possibly think this wouldn't turn out to be a negative? And that's a troubling factor, I think, that has also accompanied her time in public life.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the Clintons, both of them really, have been dogged by this attitude that they're perceived to have, that somehow the rules are different for them, and that there's a certain arrogance there in their sort of disregard for what they should be held accountable for. I think it's really interesting that in her video yesterday, you know, this theme of everyday Americans, New York Times this morning saying, you know, she's staying away from the term middle class voters because the middle class is so out of reach for so many voters it almost doesn't mean anything anymore, and they're using everyday Americans. But it also strikes me that part of her image problem is that, you know, she has sort of been a little bit aloof and above it all. And, you know, again, going back to that accountability and the secrecy and all that. So perhaps by articulating this theme of everyday Americans, she's saying, you know, I'm not above it all. I'm not aloof. I'm not the Queen of England. I'm just like you, or at least I'm in solidarity with you.
Max Brantley, can a rebranding or a listening campaign, as it were, a discussion campaign before a big kickoff next month for Hillary help to remold this very durable image that she has with a lot of people? Look, we know Democrats are going to vote for Hillary. She needs independents, and a lot of independents still don't like her.
Well, it can't hurt. It helped her in Arkansas when she took to the public to sell her husband's school reform package in 1983. That was a springboard to a great amount of success for her. I happen to think there's a side to Hillary that a lot of people haven't seen, which is she's a smart, funny, engaging person with a lot of good things to say. I think she's helped by more exposure to the real Hillary than hurt by it.
Beth Harpaz, have we ever seen the real Hillary?
Well, that was another thing that another reason that I wrote the book. You know, she came into the Senate campaign, you know, very much don't touch me. Certainly, I think there's a little bit of that image that remains that she, you know, she's not just plain folks. And it'll be interesting to see, you know, the listening campaign was this famous thing she did in New York where she went to every one of the, I think it's what, 63 counties and met with, you know, quote unquote, average people, local people, going to towns that no important person had ever been to, like Penn, New York. So it'll be interesting to see if she does that same kind of thing, you know, as she goes on this road toward the presidency, where she maybe will go to sort of whatever the local feelings are.
Max Brantley, senior editor of the Arkansas Times, a longtime family friend of the Clinton, and Beth Harpaz, author of The Girls in the Van, covering Hillary, who's a travel editor today for the Associated Press. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Well, the 2016 field continues to grow even today. Senator Marco Rubio, the first-term Republican senator from Florida, has announced his candidacy for the White House. He'll make a speech later tonight in Miami. According to the Associated Press, he broke the news to his wealthiest donors in a conference call this morning, during which he called Hillary Clinton a, quote, leader from yesterday and said he's uniquely qualified to become the next president. For more, we turn to Manuel Roig Franzia, Washington Post journalist and author of The Rise of Marco Rubio. Manuel, welcome.
Great to be here.
You're the author of The Rise of Marco Rubio. So what is The Rise of Marco Rubio? How did he get here?
There's two versions of this, right? One version is he just sort of appeared out of nowhere and was a creation of the Tea Party. And to a certain extent, that's true. But I think there's a more complicated story, a more nuanced story about the rise of Marco Rubio. And that is that he has been rising through the ranks of Republican politics in Florida since he was very young. He ran for a city commission when he was in his mid-20s. He spent 10 years in the legislature in Florida and was Speaker of the House. And he did all of that before he ran for the Senate. So it wasn't exactly instant pudding.
And like most people in his position, he certainly didn't come out of nowhere. But Manuel Roig Franzia, you mentioned Rubio's rise on the national stage because he was largely a Tea Party favorite. And it seems to me that complicates, just like so many other candidates, his path to the nomination. Very popular among the right, some of that support waned over the last couple of years over immigration. But that support on the right could make it difficult in a general election.
Yes, the key word that you used is path. Marco Rubio had been against a path to citizenship and immigration when he was running for the Senate and became the favorite of the Tea Party. Then when he got into the Senate, he embraced this plan to change the immigration system in the United States. That was a bipartisan plan run by a group called the Gang of Eight, for Republicans and for Democrats. That included a path to citizenship. When that ran into some difficulties, he backed off of that idea. And it really leaves open the question, where does he really stand on immigration?
And it really says almost as much about the current state of the Republican Party as it does about Marco Rubio himself. Here was a candidate, as you said, was propelled by support from the right, was expelled after supporting comprehensive immigration reform. And then he abandoned that position when it wasn't viable within Republican ranks. So his struggle with this issue, it seems, is very, very Republican 2016.
It's very Republican 2016. It will also be an issue for Jeb Bush if he gets into the campaign. But there's an added extra level of complexity for Marco Rubio, and that is this. As he has said, he has vowels at the end of both of his names, Marco Rubio. As a Latino, there is a different set of expectations, I believe. In the Republican Party, you can be viewed as the Latino who can help them bridge that gap with Hispanics or Latinos, whichever phrase you prefer. In the Democratic Party and in other parts of the political spectrum, there might be an expectation that a Latino candidate would be more open to sort of opening the border a little bit more. And therein lies the complication for someone who in 2016 will be attempting to navigate this very complex and, frankly, treacherous aspect of the political landscape.
And how does Marco Rubio then avoid the V word, which is Veep, which is vice president? So many people watching this race caricature him as the Latino promise of a great vice presidential candidate. It's almost an unfair sort of putting him in a box, almost dismissing his presidential aspirations and saying that he can be a good Latino brand for a party that's faltering with that voting bloc.
Part of it is his youth. You know, he's only in his early 40s, and there's oftentimes a knee-jerk reaction that somebody that young may not be ready to be at the top of the ticket. There's another knee-jerk reaction, which I think is a false one, and that is that he has little experience. The comparison will be made often that he is another Barack Obama, a first-term senator who is running for president. I think that that premise is flawed in this respect. Barack Obama was not a big deal in the Illinois legislature. Marco Rubio was a big, big deal in the Florida legislature. Barack Obama wasn't taking the lead on major controversies and fights in Illinois before he came to Washington as a senator. Marco Rubio was. So he's had this experience with the back and forth at the state level, and that may help him now as he enters this arena where everything gets magnified.
Manuel Roig-Francia, does Marco Rubio have to be careful of the grumbling that goes on in establishment Republican ranks, that all he's going to accomplish is making things harder for Jeb Bush?
I don't think that Marco Rubio is going to be worrying about bothering the Republican establishment because he has a track record of overcoming their concerns. When he ran for the Senate in 2010, the Republican establishment was firmly behind Charlie Crist, who was the governor in Florida and was a very popular national figure at that time, a guy who some people thought of as a potential vice presidential candidate or even presidential candidate. The establishment was with him. The establishment not only was with Crist, but was discouraging Rubio from running. And he ran anyway, and he proved them wrong. So if there's some grumbling in the establishment wing of the Republican Party right now, my guess is that in the Rubio camp, they not only look at that as something they don't have to worry about, they might just look at it as an advantage.
It's not just Hillary Clinton's day today. It's also Marco Rubio's day. The Republican Florida senator is in for 2016. Manuel Roig-Francia, Washington Post journalist, author of The Rise of Marco Rubio. Thank you.
It was a pleasure to be with you.
You're listening to The Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry. Here's a quick appeal. The more subscribers we have, the easier it is for us to attract the sponsors to keep our show going. So if you like the program, please let folks know. A Facebook like or a follow on Twitter means so much. Thanks again for downloading this podcast, which is brought to you by the fine folks at WNYC and Public Radio International.
On Saturday, an Egyptian court sentenced an American citizen, Mohammed Sultan, to life in prison for supporting an Islamist protest against the military's removal of President Mohammed Morsi in 2013. More than 35 others were sentenced to the same punishment. Muhammad's father, Saleh Sultan, a senior member of the Muslim Brotherhood, was sentenced to death by the same judge last month in a separate mass trial. Muhammad's sister, Hana Sultan, has been campaigning for the release of her brother and her father since their imprisonment, and she joins me now. Hana, welcome.
Hi, Todd. Thanks for having me.
What is the state of your appeals to the Egyptian government, and what help are you getting from the United States government in trying to free your brother and also your father?
Right. Well, technically, our appeals to the Egyptian government are going through two different routes, through the legal system, so local counsel for both my father and my brother over there. And appeals process is set to start for another 40 days. So we obviously plan on going that route for both of them. The other route, which is the route I've personally been sort of spearheading, is through the U.S. government. And where we are right now is State Department and White House, and the White House have both publicly stated their disappointment and their condemnation of the sentence given to Muhammad, and they have demanded his immediate release. And so at this point, we are hoping that diplomatically the Egyptian government will honor that, given that it's one of our major allies. President Obama has just released a substantial amount of aid that had been held for a long time to Egypt, and certainly concessions in the Human Rights Department would have been a proper response to that. But more importantly, and most importantly in this case, is an American citizen who has, you know, is being held, who has been tortured, who is in desperate need of medical attention that he has not received at all. I definitely had a lot of hope that that would be an understanding reached before the aid was released.
One of the main issues here also is that your brother was tried en masse with dozens and dozens of other defendants. It makes it hard to single out exactly what he may have done or may not have done because the facts of his case were not tried individually. So help us understand exactly what your brother Muhammad Sultan did do to warrant arrest back in 2013. How did he get into this mess?
Right. The fact that he is being tried in a mass trial and it is hard to separate him and all of those things, that's just emblematic of the judiciary in Egypt right now. It's completely politicized, and that is just how things have been going. But Muhammad is accused of misinforming the media with the purpose of destabilizing the state, which in layman's term really means speaking to foreign media, which is not a crime here, but it is in Egypt, or it has been made one. So he was kind of a de facto citizen journalist at the time. Basically, he became the guy that was either live tweeting things that those guys could use in their coverage of the protests, or he was helping them set up interviews. And that is precisely what he's being tried for right now.
Now, Egypt doesn't have a First Amendment. I guess we all understand that. But a life sentence for the kind of controversial speech your brother was making, helping out journalists or tweeting on behalf of someone that the new government didn't approve of.
Right.
Is there any room that you perceive from the Egyptian government to lessen this sentence? It's hard, almost impossible for a lot of Americans to imagine a life sentence for an American citizen exhibiting this kind of speech.
Absolutely. And because of that, I don't have any faith in the Egyptian government and obviously their sense of justice. I only have faith that our government will try to do everything that it takes to protect its citizen.
Hana Sultan is from Northern Virginia. She is campaigning for the release from Egyptian prisons of her brother and her father. Her brother, a U.S. citizen, sentenced to life in prison for aiding American media and protesting against the government in 2013. Hana Sultan, thank you.
Thank you.
One of the epic performances in the annals of the sport.
On Sunday, 21-year-old Jordan Spieth became the second youngest player to win the Masters tournament at Augusta National Golf Club in Georgia. And of course, that club has a long and storied tradition, and some of it shameful. Up until 1990, Augusta National did not admit African Americans, and the course didn't allow women on the greens until 2012. Even now, only a select few women get to play there. Now, drive just over 100 miles southwest on I-20, and you hit Macon, Georgia, a city that not long ago was also a bastion of segregation. Despite social movements and civil rights throughout the late 40s and 50s across the South and in the rest of the country, Macon, Georgia remained largely segregated well into the 1960s. The tide began to turn in Macon, however, in 1961, but not on the buses or at the hospitals or in housing or even in the laundromats. The first place to become integrated in Macon, Georgia was the Charles L. Bowden Golf Course. Michael Caputo, the Macon bureau chief at Georgia Public Broadcasting, detailed this little-known hidden history recently as the golf course was listed on the National Register of Historic Places, and he joins me now. Michael, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, set the scene a little bit for us. What was the interaction between African Americans and whites prior to this integration on the golf course in Macon? Were black people allowed on the course at all?
Well, yeah, actually they were. I mean, ever since the course opened in September of 1940, African Americans caddied at the public course. Among those caddies was a gentleman named Nathaniel Veal, and he recalled how the caddies played their own brand of golf by the clubhouse in the rough. It was a game that was called two-hole. Here's Mr. Veal.
We had two holes, one short hole and one longer hole. And instead of like, you got nine holes, we just had two. And if you hit the ball if it went in the fairway, we couldn't play it. You had to drop it out the fairway in the rough. Because if they just wasn't going to have you out there on the golf course.
Now the physical plant of this golf course, the actual property, had a history of its own.
It really did. The Roosevelt New Deal and the WPA helped build this golf course, as it did all across the country. Many public golf courses were built through the WPA, and it democratized the game. It allowed for people who didn't have a lot of money to play the game, and it really did spread the game to a much broader audience. This is one of the few New Deal-created golf courses, Bowden, that actually retains its look as it looked back in the 1930s and 40s.
So in 1961, African Americans in Macon petitioned the city to be able to play on the golf course, even while, as I mentioned, buses, the hospital, housing, other places, lunch counters, remained segregated. Why did they choose the Bowden Golf Course?
Well, really what happened with this particular situation was they were petitioning for years and really getting nowhere with these petitions. They were being ignored. Sam McPhee is the Maconite. He's a business leader here in town who spearheaded getting Bowden on the National Register of Historic Places. Here's how he described what they did.
There were hundreds of people in 1954 that were signed a petition to do this, and after years and years of delay, that narrowed down to probably just a handful of golfers, as you can imagine.
And so they were petitioning all along, and in 1955, the U.S. Supreme Court case Holmes v. Atlanta allowed for there to be integration of golf courses. But it just wasn't happening in Macon. It wasn't happening in many of the other places in Georgia. And then finally, this smaller, shrunk-down group decided to take things into their own hands. One of them, by the way, is still living. There was a foursome. Walter Worthen is his name. And he was among these four people who decided to take this action. Nathaniel Veal tells the story the best.
They was playing in Atlanta and different places, and so they wanted to play, and they asked to play, but they wouldn't let them play. And so finally they went to city council and said, we're going to play, and they came out and played, and everything been going well ever since.
So wait, they were denied access to the golf course, and then they just went and said, well, we're going to tee off, and they kind of did, and everyone sort of went, all right.
They slung their bags over their shoulder. This is including this Mr. Worthen, who, by the way, said being a caddy made this risk easier. They just decided we're going to put the bags on. We're going to walk through the front door instead of the back door. We're going to go out and we're going to play and we're going to see what happens. And nothing happened to them. They played. Word got around. They went to the city council days later, and finally the city council said, all right, we'll integrate. And it was merely just going out there and doing it that made it happen.
How much after that did you start playing?
The next day. For real. Not real. Maybe not the next day, but that weekend. Because, I was working and saw it on TV, and every black person, man in Macon bought clubs and started playing golf.
Every black man in Macon bought clubs and started playing golf, Michael Caputo, but what about the women?
Well, the women, that came along much, much later. I do believe that you can look at this area now and this public golf course, and you'll see men and women playing, but it took a much longer time for that to happen. There are now both tournaments for both men and women at the golf course, and in fact, the current women's champion, she's an African-American woman, and she's been champion for, her name is Alice Jackson, for 8 or 9 years straight. It's quite a remarkable place, and it's also quite interesting that the history of the place hadn't been told. Sam McPhee has actually created a video that showcases the story of Mr. Worthen, the last living member of this foursome, and talks about this very interesting, very nonviolent way of integrating.
Michael Caputo, our president, the first African-American president, loves to play golf every single weekend. This seems like the kind of place maybe he would want to play before leaving office.
That would be a very interesting thought. And maybe Mr. Worthen and Mr. McPhee can petition him or something. We'll see.
part of the history of civil rights, part of the history of integration, told over 9 holes in Macon, Georgia at the Bowden Golf Course. Michael Caputo is Macon Bureau Chief at Georgia Public Broadcasting. Great story, Michael.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And here's something to take with you today. This week, the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee will begin to rewrite No Child Left Behind for the first time in more than a decade. There's hope this could signal a new era in education in the United States. Teachers, we want to hear from you. What changes would you make?
My name is Jennifer, and I'm calling from Buffalo, New York. My recommendation for revising NCLB would be to keep the annual testing, grades 3 through 8 in high school and mathematics, but switch to an assessment of social studies in grades 3, 5, and 7, and then science 4, 6, and 8, so that rather than focusing on an ELA test, we're assessing students' reading and writing in science and social studies.
There's one teacher who knows exactly what she wants from No Child Left Behind, but here's the rub. The federal government controls about 8% of all education funding in the United States, the rest from state and local governments and taxes. Can Washington really make a difference here? Give us a call at 8778-MY-TAKE. You can send us tweets at The Takeaway. If you want to take The Takeaway with you, subscribe to our podcast. You can find us on iTunes and take us with you on your commute home from work. It's a great way to stay up on the news. Again, find us on iTunes or on any service where you get your podcast fix. And you can ask me anything on Twitter. Follow me around Washington. I'm at Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for listening. I am Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.